You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
This special episode of the Grace Saves All podcast is being recorded live at First Christian Church in Tyler, Texas. A prominent East Texas town of 107,000 residents. First Christian Church is a congregation of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. The Christian Church Disciples of Christ, or just Disciples in shorthand, is known for our open-minded approach to Christian faith, where we not only allow, but also expect each member of the church to follow Jesus as Lord and Savior to their own best understanding of God and the Bible as they live that out in a church community in loving and grace-filled ways. I am personally indebted to the Disciples denomination because it gives not only church members but also ministers as well the room to grow spiritually in authentic ways. I will be forever grateful that the Disciples denomination allowed me the room for my own faith in God to grow to the point in which I came to understand that God's grace is big enough not only to finally save everyone, but also to restore the entire creation and take all of us on a never-ending and always expanding journey into the inexhaustible love and beauty of God. So, yay God, yay Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and yay First Christian Church in Tyler, Texas. I am especially pleased to be at this church because my longtime friend and ministerial colleague, Chris Pulliam, is the senior minister here. And I'm also excited because of a unique ministry that's developed here underneath the leadership of my co-host for this interview, Jonathan Benedetti.
Hello, friends.
Jonathan is a staff member here at First Christian Tyler, who is responsible for what they are calling Open Table Faith, which is their attempt to create a safe space for spiritual refugees who are needing to process and heal and reorient themselves towards a more positive spiritual direction. So thank you, Jonathan Benedetti and Senior Minister Chris Pulliam and everyone else at First Christian Tyler for providing the funding and the space to make this event possible. And so Jonathan, as we're getting started here, tell us just a little more about Open Table Faith at First Christian Church in Tyler, Texas.
Sure. Thanks, David. So Open Table Faith exists to create safe space for honest conversation about God and faith and life. We also want to encourage spiritual exploration and theological imagination, even theological rehabilitation, and also to promote compassionate living. So we're trying to do all of this in a safe, encouraging, inclusive environment. And the whole goal of what we're doing is so that people perhaps who have gone through what's popularly called deconstruction or a changing of their mind or of their beliefs, who've had an evolution of their faith, who are asking questions, who are expressing doubts, can know, A, they're not crazy, and B, they are not alone. So we want to create a big welcome table to invite, like you said, spiritual refugees and doubters and questioners and those just looking for an open-minded, open-hearted expression.
Right. So if I'm willing to be a member of First Christian Church Tyler and come to the worship services here, then I can participate in this program?
Well, if you are a member here, you are certainly welcome to participate in this program. But yeah. Open Table Faith is not an effort to in any way recruit people to come attend or join our church. Obviously, anyone is welcome whenever they want to come. But the whole goal is not to just drive people into church, but it's actually to do ministry in our community with those who need it most. So, all right. There's no bait and switch. There's no hook.
Good, good. I just want to let people, there may be people a little cynical about church.
That's right. Yeah, me too.
Okay, and now on to introduce our interviewee for this evening, Dr. Mentana Campbell. Dr. Campbell has a PhD in counseling and counselor education from Texas Christian University, which she completed in 2020. She also holds a Master's of Community Mental Health Counseling from Regent University, completed in 2015, as well as a Master's of Divinity from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, completed in 1995. And just from that snapshot, we can already detect quite of a theological journey that she has been on. Mentana is a licensed professional counselor, as well as an adjunct professor at Texas Christian University and B.H. Carroll Seminary. Dr. Campbell recently sent me an email requesting further information about one of my episodes of the Grace Saves All podcast. In our correspondence, I realized what a well-educated and interesting and capable person she was. And long story short, it's all worked out to have Dr. Campbell with us live and in person this evening, primarily to discuss her work around religion and trauma. Welcome, Dr. Mentana Campbell, to Open Table Faith at First Christian Church, Tyler, Texas, and to the Grace Saves All podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm thrilled.
So, Mentana, as we get started, is there anything you'd just like to add to this introduction?
I know, it's quite a fabulous introduction. So, thank you, David. You did well.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So, as we get into this interview, I'll be asking general questions, and then Jonathan, if you have a question that occurs to you, you can ask it from the perspective of your experience here at Open Table Faith here in Tyler. So as we get started, you know, Mentana, we are in a world where religion and trauma are increasingly being associated with each other, and why do you think that is?
I think there's probably a lot of answers to that. I think the thing that I think about most is just kind of the explosion of trauma theory in the last, you know, couple of decades. It's probably the fastest growing area in the mental health field. And I think it's for a lot of reasons, just what we know more about neurology, what we know more about physiology, what happens with trauma, things like that. And so, so trauma theory, just by its very nature, is always looking to kind of expand, to see different places where it shows up, how it affects different aspects of ourselves. And so we've kind of moved from kind of that shell shock, World War I type of understanding of trauma, PTSD, and things like that. Do I need to define PTSD? I'm looking at Jonathan because I was informed that he would give me a signal if I used vocabulary that maybe was not understandable. So...
Mentana, what is PTSD?
Exactly? Jonathan, what a wonderful question. How insightful of you. Post-traumatic stress disorder. So we were seeing soldiers coming back, obviously, from battle and things like that they were exhibiting these symptoms, right? So intrusive thoughts and memories and hypervigilance, insomnia, things like that. So, and trauma theory has been kind of developing since then, really looking more towards, okay, hey, it's not just soldiers when they come back from war. Like, we're noticing kids that grow up in abusive families or people who've been sexually abused. We're noticing these same types of symptoms happening in these different places. Well, so, and again, so trauma theory is just growing and growing and growing. And then in the early 90s, we had some research into, wait a minute, I wonder what's different about trauma when it happens in religious spaces or by people who kind of represent God. And so in the early 90s, that kind of started with like clergy sexual abuse, kind of cult-related kind of things. And that's where really religious trauma study, as far as like an academic study, like we all know, religious trauma has been happening like since day one, right? Let's crusades, Salem witch trials, all kinds of things, right? Inquisition, need I say more? But as far as being an academic study, that's kind of early 90s. And so I think that's a big piece of it. And you only have to go to TikTok, right? Like, well, maybe before it gets shut down, but like, you can look up religious trauma and you can have all kinds of people talking about it. Some I would not recommend that you listen to, but others that have some, you know, interesting experiences or thoughts about it. And it's just permeated our culture. And you hear people using trauma language all the time. And that just kind of tells you how pervasive it is. Like, oh, I was so triggered or, you know, things like that. So, so I think that's part of the reason. And so we started seeing these trauma symptoms developing in lots of places and spaces. We've started the religious trauma work and then it just continued to grow with our understanding of what's called complex PTSD. So complex PTSD is where there's not just an event that happens, but maybe you're in a system or an environment or a family where abusive thoughts, words, actions are happening over time. And so we were noticing different types of similar symptoms to PSD, some things that were a little bit different than those. And so I think that really opened up the field of religious trauma. I think that's one reason. I have lots of other ideas about it, but I think that's a big one.
Well, one of the things that we had an event last night with Open Table Faith where people shared some of their experiences that they felt were traumatic. Some of the experiences had to do with always feeling like even though they had gone, they were at church, they had given their lives to Christ, that still they might still be going to hell. So they needed to would obsessively rededicate themselves over and over again. I talked to one man who said that he was put in a situation where he was told that not only was it his responsible to witness to other people, but that if they weren't converted, that by his witnessing to them, that their blood was on his hands. And so it was not only fear for himself, but he also had to perform at this super high level, or he was going to be guilty for their not being and saved. So when did people start feeling like, okay, that kind of teaching about hell is just it's traumatic, or at least we know that people are experiencing it as it traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Kind of when did that start happening?
Yeah.
Is that kind of the question? I think it's what happens is we started seeing, especially with like hell anxiety. So that's a kind of how we talk about it.
Hell anxiety.
That's
a thing. That's a real thing.
It's a thing, right? So it's this kind of existential angst, right? Like, is my eternal fate to be burning in hell forever? And how do I know if it is or it isn't? And the interesting thing about trauma, and let me just say this, because trauma in a sense is subjective. Okay, so when we define trauma, we kind of talk about two components. We talk about the traumatic experience, and then we talk about our response to it. So two people could be in the same church, hearing the same type of belief systems, and one begins to exhibit signs of trauma because of it, and the other doesn't. So there is this subjectivity to it, but that's true of all trauma. You could have two people in a car accident, one person has post-traumatic stress kind of symptoms and the other doesn't, or things like that. So we just start noticing that some people are actually, over time, in certain environments. And I think because we started studying with high kind of control religious cults and kind of noticing the long-term impact of being in a really kind of cult-like environment, and I think we started saying, oh, you know what, there's some similar things happening with certain people given certain faith teachings or religious beliefs, and hell anxiety being one. There's a guy that's got some writing out, I think it's Mike Karras, I'm not quite sure how to say his last name. He talks about the diabolical trinity. So he talks about God's wrath, hell, and what was the third one? I just went blank.
But we'll just say the rapture.
Yeah, the rapture. Oh my gosh, you're right.
Well, I like to say that when it comes to fear, that the hell bone is connected to the rapture bone.
The hell bone is
because you could think, okay, I might be doing well enough, like I'm going to church some. I don't go to church every Sunday, but you know, I think that if I died, I would go to heaven. But if Jesus comes back, he might be only taking the people that are super on fire, and so I might miss the rapture, and then I'd have to go through the tribulation, and so there could be, you know, like fear at that level too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So now it might be fairly easy for somebody that's sort of been directly involved in all this to say, wait a second, I think I've experienced some trauma. But some people, like they go to a church and hell is not really talked about too much at the church, but it's also not talked about. It's just kind of an invisible thing at the church. But they live in a community like, say, Tyler, where there's a lot of talk about it around them. And they may not even really realize that they have absorbed this. They may have some just feeling, some intrusive thoughts, some obsessiveness that's developed. And they might not even be aware that they have kind of received a kind of complex trauma just because they're in a place where it's just in the water all the time. Is that something that, I don't know, you have thoughts about?
Yeah, I think it's But I think it's not as invisible in the water as we sometimes think. We were driving up here and we were, I don't know, maybe 35 miles outside of Tyler. And there's a sign that says, heaven or hell, where are you going? Right on a sign, like an advertisement. Like I took my mom to the doctor the other day and there was just one of the TV stations that was playing. And twice the same commercial came up and said, do you know where you're going? Your eternal destination? And it had like a heavenorhell.net. And I actually went to it because I wanted to see what was there.
So, where are you going?
I don't believe in, well, wait a minute. Okay, wait.
Okay, well, that's, yeah.
David, you went too far there. But anyway, so I don't think the water's as invisible as we think it is. Like, I think there's one of the things that's really interesting in the construct that I'm studying, which we'll get into later, but is that spiritual struggles is what I study, actually, which includes spiritual trauma, but is not just restricted to that.
Yeah, because I wanted to get to that because, you know, think maybe sometimes the trauma language it's helped if we introduce spiritual struggle language. So I want you to talk about that.
Yeah. But let me just say about that, what's interesting in that research is we find even atheists who are self-identified atheists will have spiritual struggles. And I think that's evidence of this stuff that's in the water. I say I don't believe in God, but at the end of the day, when I'm sick or something happens, like I have all this anxiety and this angst. So, yeah.
Jonathan, ask a question.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've noticed is what's interesting in you talking about maybe it doesn't seem as immediately visible, or then again, maybe it does, is watching cult documentaries and then realizing, man, there's some of that stuff that just feels so familiar, you know? And so it's interesting that what there's practices, communal practices, or things you participate in that are just normalized, that you just think, oh, that's just the way that it is, until you get outside of it and you realize, hold on, that actually might have been trauma, or that might have been really toxic or destructive. Now, in your work, I mean, do you encounter people like that who are like, I would have been traumatized for a long time, I just didn't know it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, after Happy Shiny People came out, like, the number of clients I saw after that just, like, shot up, and it was like, I have Happy Shiny People, and I didn't realize.
Wait a second.
Okay.
What's Happy Shiny People?
It's a documentary about the Bill Gothard movement and the family. Y'all help me out. The Duggar family, who was a part of that kind of Bill Gothard. Very kind of fundamentalist, very, we're going to tell you what you wear, what you watch, what you don't, stuff like that. So I actually got an influx of people, even if they weren't in the Bill Gothard kind of church, like legit. So many of the same messages were within their church, kind of the water of their church, like rock, you don't listen to rock music and, you know, all kinds of things like that. So I think that's kind of to your point. You watch all these things and this comes out and you're like, wait a minute, that feels really familiar. And I didn't even know that was a thing until I saw that. And all of a sudden I'm feeling some anxiety in my body over it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So is it possible that I could be having a spiritual struggle that is not traumatic?
Yes.
Say something about that.
Okay. Well, let me just kind of give a little nerdy like definition,
good,
if that's okay, and just kind of tell you what it is. So, spiritual struggles come out of the religious coping literature, and that's where I discovered it. And it's a spiritual struggle is there's three domains of struggle and six types. And just bear with me for a second. People already went to sleep. But so the three domains are this. They're supernatural struggles, interpersonal, and intrapsychic. And so the supernatural struggles are divine and demonic struggles. So divine struggles would be kind of what you think of. Something terrible's happened to me. Where was God when that happened? I thought this traumatic event happened. I felt like God abandoned me or betrayed me, or maybe the life I'm having is because God's punishing me. That's a divine struggle. A demonic struggle is, now lots of believers or people of faith believe in a very active supernatural world. It's not that you just believe in demons or Satan or something like that, but it's that you're being personally harmed and attacked by them in such a way that you're maybe even scared to turn out your light, go to sleep. You feel completely out of control because this demonic activity is kind of coming against you. So those are supernatural struggles. The next ones are interpersonal, and that's where religious trauma falls within this framework. So an interpersonal struggle is any type of conflict or distress with people of faith, with institutions of faith, things like that. So there's a personal element to it. There's people involved. And so that can be everything from I went to church and the pastor got up and made a confession about a moral failing. And now I even wonder what this whole church God thing's about. That's an interpersonal struggle. It could be that you're in a family where certain faith beliefs are taught that are maybe counter to what you are. Or maybe, for example, maybe a gay young teenager and his parents, you know, don't believe that that's an appropriate lifestyle. So that's an interpersonal struggle, all the way up to, you know, I was abused by a pastor or I was abused in a religious environment. So that would be an interpersonal struggle. And just the last one, just because I want you to know also where faith deconstruction kind of falls within this framework is intrapsychic. So intrapsychic just means all the things that are kind of happening within us and our thoughts and things like that. So there are three types there. There's the doubt related struggle, which is really where deconstruction falls. It's really more of kind of this cognitive intellectual exercise of, hey, I was taught this. I don't know if I believe it anymore. I want to read this. I want to listen to the Grace Saves All podcast, things like that. So that's the doubt related struggle. Mm-hmm. And then there's moral related struggles. Oh, my faith institution taught me this, but I'm living like this. Or, you know, a lot of struggles with purity culture would fall under some stuff like this. And then the last one is ultimate purpose. Like, why am I here? What meaning does life have? Mm-hmm. And so it's a much broader, which is actually really why I like it, as opposed to, but it does include spiritual trauma and deconstruction, but it includes more than that.
Yeah, I think that's helpful language for what you're doing, is to say that we're not just helping people, we're helping people with spiritual struggles and trauma, and it's just might be a helpful umbrella term.
Absolutely. So yeah, I'm going to need those notes afterwards.
You can have them. Wait, I've got a book coming out. You can actually buy
okay.
I mean, was that just, well, that was horrible.
What, do you have
it?
The title for the book?
It is. Okay. Let me just say it is an academic book, but I do think it's going to be really accessible because it's a qualitative study. So lots of stories from actual people. Yeah, the name of the book is Counseling and the Resolution of Spiritual Struggles. So it's kind of looking at how counselors can work
and
with people.
And like that. When is it going to come out?
They
do you
say
know?
October, November. So well, it's due in a week and I'm here. My manuscript is due in 1 week and I'm here.
Okay, well.
You're important to me.
That will be another, yes, that will. We'll definitely want the Grace Saves All podcast interview for that one too. Well, what are some of the main issues that throw people into deconstruction or trauma from your experience?
Okay. I'm gonna give a general answer, just kind of an umbrella answer, and then I'm gonna tell you what I see most as a therapist. Okay. And kind of like the frequency of it. And so you kind of have a couple of different answers there. Really what throws anybody into a spiritual struggle is that there's some type of adversity or experience that happens that you don't have the coping ability to deal with. Right? It just exceeds your ability to deal with it. And so that can be a lot of different things. I like to talk a little bit about I don't really like the metaphor. I need a better one. But kind of a coping tool belt, you know, when things happen, we all have a coping tool belt and it's got positive coping. It's got negative coping in there. So say you lose your job and positive coping might be, hey, you call a friend, I lost a job, help me out. Maybe negative coping is you go and you get, you know, really drunk and, you know, do other nefarious kinds of things. Not real helpful to you. But we also have positive and negative religious coping in there as well. So we have this tool belt that we're always trying to deal with things. And when the experience or the adversity, you're like, I don't have enough tools in my tool belt for that. That's also trauma, by the way. Sometimes it can be experienced as trauma, but it can also be experienced as a spiritual struggle. So I would say, and I probably need to say this, I work at a counseling center that's sponsored by a church. So a lot of clientele that come to see me want either their religious and spiritual beliefs to be a part of therapy, at least respected, at the very least, and or they're struggling with their faith on some level. But even if it's not, we're really well known in the community, so we see all sorts and non-religious and all things as well. But I do probably get access to more clientele that have some type of religious or spiritual kind of foundation. So just know that. But there's probably not a client I see that there's not some form of spiritual struggle in place. sometimes trauma, but definitely a spiritual struggle. And so I would say the things that I see most are really this kind of, I'm trying to think of a good way to talk about it, but it's like, I would call it kind of disillusionment, disappointment. We were talking about it a little bit tonight at dinner, where I have this way that I believe life's supposed to be, and I believe that God wants me to have this kind of life. I believe it's supposed to look like this, but actually my life is like this. So there's dissonance, right? But what's super interesting about it, and this is kind of the key part kind of therapeutically, is what they say they believe and what they're living out are very different things. So I call it the difference between lived and learned theology. So learned theology is kind of like, yeah, God is sovereign and God is love and God is good and God, you know, all the things. But what we actually live out can be something very different. So for example, somebody might say, you know, I felt like if I went to seminary and I was really obedient and I did all these things, God would get me this great job. Maybe I'd have this pastorate at this kind of church, and it doesn't happen, right? Well, that's a lived theology that's more transactional, right? If I do these things, God will do these things. And that just, it's kind of a soft prosperity gospel that underlies a lot of evangelical thought. It's just, it's baked into it in some ways, or even what I call a little bit of an appeasement theodicy. Like, if I do A, B, and C, which usually looks like I'm really good, you know, reading my Bible or praying or whatever, and I'm obedient and maybe I don't have sex before marriage, then I'm going to get that good marriage and I'm going to appease this divine being and get what I want out of life. And then when it doesn't happen, everything starts to fall apart. So I would say in general, it's something along those lines that I deal with, that I see the most. After that, I would kind of rank it something along the lines of actual trauma, whether it doesn't even have to be religious trauma, right? There's some type of traumatic event that happens and people are like, where was God? Like, I can't even believe this happened to me. I do a lot of work in sexual identity in particular. So a lot of rubbing in faith kinds of things, like I'm in a faith community that says this is not an okay type of identity to have, but this is my experience. So a lot of work with that kind of stuff. And I would say it's probably kind of along those lines that I see. Now, when I'm actually seeing religious trauma, which I do, it's typically, and maybe it's my connection to the church, maybe it's my own background, but I see a lot of people that experience religious trauma on the mission field, missionary kids, ministers, things like that. So I see a lot within that context.
Okay, so how does the topic of hell then, does that ever come up in the conversations that you have with people?
You know, hell doesn't actually come up as much as you would think, other than, like, it'll be in conjunction with things like, just very recently I've been working with this young man who's about 16, gay, in a Southern Baptist church. So we all know that's a non-affirming denomination, and was taken to lunch by his youth minister and said, if you choose this, you're going to go to hell. So he comes in obviously very traumatized by that. So sometimes it's in conjunction with things like that. If you don't have a certain moral standing, then you're going to go to hell. Not so much that they're questioning it, but some of the anxiety that comes along with some of the messages they're receiving. Yeah.
Okay. Jonathan, you have any questions to add at this point? Okay. Well, at this point, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your own story, about your journey, and just how that worked out in your own life.
Gosh, that's a big question. So that's a really big question, isn't it? I've been through several, I would call them, I've had several spiritual struggles over the course of my lifetime. And I like the big broad category for me. I wouldn't have said initially that I experienced any religious trauma personally, but when I kind of read about what spiritual struggles were, I'm like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden it gave me language for my experience that I didn't have before. And I was kidding with you over dinner that I have this kind of metaphor of like, you know, being out on a frozen lake. And you're out there playing, and it's like really solid. And you're like, oh, this is cool. This is like ground. Like, you know, and you're out there, it's fine. It's fine. And you see a little crack, and you're like, oh, there's a crack, but it's still pretty solid. And for me, being, you know, growing up Southern Baptist, growing up my entire life being Southern Baptist and things like that, most of those initial cracks were about around questions of gender, what women can and can't do, things like that. So there's all these little cracks in there. But I would say the big crack, if you will, came when we moved to France. So we worked with a mission organization, a Southern Baptist mission organization in France, and we were there for 10 years. And you get there. Now, I don't know if you know much about France other than the great wine and baguettes and cheese, which are all true, by the way. Every last one of them true.
But first of all, really, I think way to go for falling on the sword of going to be a missionary to France.
Thank you.
Really, I mean.
Here am I, Lord, send me, right? I mean, it is so funny because in the missionary world, you have like the tippy top, you know, like the people are going to these unreached people groups and in places where you can die.
Yeah.
And I went to France.
Right? Yeah, where we all want to go.
Where everybody wants to go. And nobody cared that I was there. Right. That's the hard thing about France.
Who cares about the French?
Right. And they're like, you're here to start churches. Why? This is Notre Dame, which there's a Notre Dame in every city in France. Okay. It's Our Lady. It's the Catholic church in the town. Okay. So why are you here? So yeah, it was a hard mission field if you're trying to go start churches and tell people about Jesus and get their souls saved, right? It's a really tough place to go because they didn't care. And I think that was kind of where the big crack started in that sense was just, we had to fill out these monthly reports of how many evangelistic conversations we had, how many times we shared the gospel, how many times somebody got saved, how many baptisms, how many Bible studies, how many church starts. And for 10 years, when you put a big fat zero, when you answer that question, zero, 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 you kind of start to feel like a failure, right? And what's really horrible about being a failure on the mission field in this kind of structure is your failure results in people going to hell, right?
So in the theology that you took over to France, who were you trying to save from going to hell? Like, was a Catholic person considered somebody you needed to convert in your theology at that time?
Well, most French, in a lot of ways, even French people would say they're culturally Catholic.
Okay.
France self-identifies, if you will, as kind of post-Christian, right? So they'll still do baptism and same things like that in the Catholic Church. But as far as practicing Catholics, it's a pretty small number. They don't really know what a Protestant is. Only about 2% of the population claims to be Protestant.
So like the idea of having a personal relationship with Jesus as your Lord and Savior and being saved by faith, and you're trying to explain all of this to them.
Right. In French. That I didn't speak before, but yes, exactly. I did not have the gift of tongues. I'll put it that way.
Okay. So that was a bigger crack in your faith. And then what did that lead to?
Well, so really, like my husband and I he's right there. We started in Paris. We started in Paris and did student work there. But when we moved to Marseille, I'd just had two children, so they were young'uns. We didn't know anybody in Marseille. Scott was traveling a lot because only the men with the Southern Baptists get to do things officially. Officially do things. I was home and family. But all that to say, I was at home a lot by myself in a city where I didn't know anybody. And again, you're just goose egging this monthly questionnaire, right? And I think just over time with that sense of failure, there was some depression. Our marriage was under a lot of stress. We were not doing well. And I think there was this one moment where I had that story of Jesus was in my mind crossing the lake with his disciples and he's asleep and the storm comes. And I'm like, that's it. Like, you've called me here and I am perishing and you don't care. Like, what in the world? Like, I don't know what words I can say.
Thank you. This is a family podcast.
This is a family podcast. And yeah, and so just I think that was the first, like the crack in the ice did this. Now I didn't plummet through the water just yet. We came back to the States. I did some counseling that was helpful for some of the depression and stuff like that. But I don't think I had any concept of all the things that were happening at that time. Kind of this spiritual struggle idea. I think I was just like, I was depressed. I was away from family, had two small kids. My marriage was struggling.
You mentioned that you were reading, trying to sort of get fired up by going, like reading like John Piper and some things like that. Like you were trying to sort of light the fire back again. And tell us about how that worked.
Yeah. So one of the things that I learned in my research, and this was kind of one of the reasons I was telling David about this, was kind of how people slide into spiritual struggles or deconstruction or whatever. That's kind of one of the things that my research kind of showed is how do we go from this really hard thing to be like, I don't care if I ever go to church again. Kind of like there's a pathway there. It's not just, it didn't happen overnight. Right. And so part of what I learned initially was kind of after the onset of that event, a lot of people just kind of turned to these individual coping strategies that we were kind of talking about earlier.
Right.
And so, and that's part of it, right? Well, my faith tradition taught me that when I'm depressed, what do? We pray, we read our Bible, we lay it at the foot of the cross, whatever that means, right? We do all these things. And so when it doesn't work, when you do it over and over and over again, and you're not seeing a solution, you're not seeing it fixed, I'm going to read some books. Well, John Piper was just all the rage at the time. You know, the Passion conferences, all that kind of stuff. You just don't waste your life. You go out there, you do everything. Well, like, well, my joy in God is not enough. It's my fault because I don't trust, my joy in God is not deep and strong enough that other people are being drawn to God for it. So there's all these things you do.
You're so passionate, you're so alive that people just see the vibrancy and the passion of your faith. And there's like, I want whatever she has.
Yes. Yes, that my joy is being fulfilled in Christ, and that's attractive to people. It draws people. Or the big stories around the mission field are if God moves when people get together and pray. So we need to get together and pray more. We need to have all night prayer vigils. This is how revival starts, right?
So you were wanting revival to break out,
right? But like, I wasn't praying near enough for that.
But that depended upon, in order for the revival to break out, that depended on how intense your prayer was and how on fire you were.
Yes.
And so that was adding more pressure to all of that.
Yes.
And maybe you didn't know exactly how much it had to be to qualify for revival level prayer. The only thing you knew was it wasn't enough. Whatever you were doing was not enough.
Exactly.
Which seems to be a through line through a lot of people's spiritual struggles is that whatever it is, whether it's prayer, whether it's witnessing, whether it's even caring for the poor, whatever it is, whatever I'm supposed to be doing, I'm not doing enough of it. And so I'm carrying around that shame narrative that's connected with that. Has that been, just kind of as a side note, did you have that feeling, and have you talked to clients who have experienced that?
Yes. You got to my second crack in the ice that sent me to the bottom of the pond.
Okay. Good job.
I mean, it's like you were prophetic right there, right? Stuff like that's only funny with people who are from faith backgrounds, right? Like people, like other people listen to this podcast and be like, that's not funny. Yes, exactly. So the second crack that sent me to the bottom was I've been a journaler my whole life. And there were about four or five journals I couldn't find for a really long time. It was kind of from the college years all the way up through kind of marriage. And because I was on church staff first before we went overseas. And so I was like, where are those journals? And I had this fireproof box in my closet that I'd lost the key to a long time ago. And we were back home, and this was probably 2019, something like that. And I was telling this guy, I was like, I can't find that key. And he looks at me and goes, I can bust that open for you. And I'm like, why haven't we done that? And so he goes and he busts it open, and these journals are in there. And of course, I want to read them because I haven't seen them in forever. And I start reading through these journals, and that was just the end. I was a really spiritually sensitive kid. And there's an achiever in me. It's like in the sense of, hey, this is what it means to be a good Christian. I'm like, I am on it. Like we read our Bibles every day. I've read the Bible through in a year, like all the things, right? And these journals, I'll spare you, but it's like entry after entry after entry of all the ways I've fallen short, How, gosh, if I, okay, God, I'm so sorry. I wish I desired you more. I'll get up tomorrow. I'll pray longer tomorrow. And so when you say that, I have this, it's almost like I had this image of God, almost like a mirage, right? That the sooner I got, the closer I got to it, the further away it got. You know, you had William Paul, whoever on
William
your,
Paul Young, yeah, wrote The Shack.
Yeah, and he talked about that lie of separation, you know, that we're actually not separate from God. And I was like, I always felt separate. Yes. And I always felt like it was up to me to get close to God. And the way that I got close to God was through all my obedience, right? And so now, obviously, as a therapist, I'm reading these journals. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is not healthy. You talk about attachment. Like, this is anxious attachment, case.
Yeah, so you were not securely, you were not securely attached to God.
No.
You had an anxious attachment,
yes,
to God.
Pursuing, is this enough? Am I enough? I'm falling short all the time. And I would use a lot of guilt and self-condemnation, like, to try to motivate myself to go further. So, yes. And that sent me to the bottom of the lake where I thought, I'm done.
And in our kind of lead up to this, you also said that your body gave you a strong signal that it was done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I think what we know in trauma theory now is, like, even in the animal kingdom does it, after an animal is attacked or is pursuing something or feels chased or whatever, what they'll do afterwards, you can watch your dog do it, actually, after the attack has subsided, they'll shake out their body, right? So you'll see a lot of people post a traumatic experience shaking kind of uncontrollably. And so you kind of, there was just this kind of shaking that was kind of going on with me in that moment, and then another critical moment much later on. But I got to this place where I actually went to this Catholic retreat center. I was writing the fifth chapter of my dissertation, which, just so you know, is the last chapter of a dissertation. So I was there and I was writing, and I'd just been reading these journals. And on my way up to this Catholic retreat center, I was talking to one of my best friends, and she was in the ER because she was having an arrhythmia. And she's like, if it doesn't stop, they're going to have to, like, shock it and try to get the heartbeat to go back, mm-hmm, to normal and all this kind of stuff. And so I'm thinking about her, writing my chapters. I take these little walks as I was taking kind of writing breaks. And it was kind of in that moment, like, I was just like, you know, reading these journals has just shown me that my heart has not been beating in a healthy way for a really long time. And the only thing I know to kind of get it back on rhythm is just to stop. And I kind of told God in that moment, I'm done. Like, I think I can't do this anymore. And that was kind of, it was weird. It was rock bottom, but something felt a little bit freeing in it too. Yeah. So that was kind of, I would say, the fissures and the.
So now that we've hit bottom, now then the question is, how do you come back up from that? How does healing begin to occur?
Yeah. For me, or just in general with spiritual struggles?
Well, I mean, in some of the notes that you sent me, you mentioned how important relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think you, in the notes, you said the highest predictor of a positive outcome in therapy is the strength of a therapeutic relationship. It isn't what we do, it's how we are with people. And I think that's pretty significant for Open Table Faith.
Absolutely.
And healing. So I'd like you to just say some more about that.
Yeah. One of the ways I looked at my research was through, and I'm going to geek out for a second, but you're going to find it really important and interesting. All my, my fellow geeks
okay.
out there. So we do a lot of study in the therapy world about, like, what helps clients change. And it's a very humbling statistic that client therapy is only responsible for 14% of client change. And of that 14%, so that means we have resources, like, outside, like, as people, we have lots of strengths, lots of resources, lots of things helping us. But within that 14%, the two factors most associated with client change, positive outcomes, was the strength of the relationship between the therapist and the client. So what was that bond like? What was that emotional connection like? How are we working together towards your goals? Things like that. So when that's strong, it's the number one predictor of client change. This, But the second thing is this, the person most responsible for the strength of that relationship is a therapist. And it's not what they do, it's not your level of training, it's not your gender, it's not the type of therapy you use, it's who you are as a person, how you show up in therapy, genuine, authentic, non-judgmental, those kinds of things, right? So I think what I love about that is that's transferable to so many different contexts. Like, you don't have to be a professionally trained therapist. You just have to show up as an authentic, genuine, compassionate, caring person and come alongside people who are hurting. And I think I use that word alongside very intentionally. So much hurt, whether it's religious trauma or spiritual struggles, is because there's this power dynamic in relationships, there's an imbalance. So there's definitely an imbalance between me and God. There's an imbalance between me and a pastor, right? They have religious authority. Even certain belief systems that we were talking about, they've been around for hundreds of years. Who am I to talk about whether hell exists or doesn't?
Yeah,
I
mean, how it exists or how we got that doctrine and all that kind of stuff.
Who am I, right, to kind of go against all these centuries of Christian thought? So there's this imbalance of power. And so one of the healing things is just to come alongside people in relationship, like as companions. Like, you're not, like what you were saying earlier perfectly in your introduction to your Open Table ministry is like, we're in this together. You are not alone. And that's super healing. Whether one of the things we're just learning about trauma is, again, I said it's subjective. Like, why are some people traumatized and some people aren't? And one of the things we're realizing is often people are traumatized or respond with traumatic stress because they don't have a witness to their pain, to their grief, to their suffering, right? There's not somebody there when that horrible thing happens, looks at them and says, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. Somebody said, oh, it's right, this is what God wanted for you, whatever, and that exacerbates that distress, right? So just witnessing, and when I say witness, I guess I need to be really careful. I don't mean evangelizing. I mean being present for someone's pain, listening to it. Just, you don't even have to say anything. Just oftentimes shut up, right? And just be with.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm impressed with First Christian Church in Tyler is it's very counterintuitive for the church, for a church to start a ministry whose goal is not to get people to come to the church, but to just put it honestly and authentically, you just be with them. And that's something you've really say something about that. That's really important for you to communicate to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, just when I see Jesus in the Gospels, I see a gentle companion. I mean, it's more complicated than that because he says some wild stuff too, but who comes alongside people, is present with them in their suffering. And for many, in a lot of ways, that's why I continue to be a Christian through my own spiritual struggles and my own doubts, is because of a God who suffers alongside us, who walks with us alongside with us. And so, we'll edit this part out because I totally lost my train of thought.
We don't edit it because I know.
Yeah, but okay. So what that is what I see, and that's what I think is important. So rather than, I am super sensitive to people who come along and appear to be coming alongside you in order to help you, but there really is still an ulterior motive. There really is a hook. It's a means to an end. It's trying to get you somewhere that's predetermined, rather than showing up, being present, and saying, I'm here for you and with you wherever this goes. And that is what I see that we need. It's what I've needed over and over in my life, have been safe relationships and friendships where I could have that kind of honest conversation, where I didn't have to worry about censoring myself, where I could just show up and be my authentic self. And that's why so much I think it's necessary. And that's a big part of kind of why we do Open Table Faith.
One of the things that I've enjoyed about doing podcasting as opposed to being in ministry is that I just put the podcast out there and people just listen to it. And if it helps them, great. But there's nothing that they have to do. I'm not trying to get them to join a church or anything like that. It's just a gift. It's just my way of trying to just sort of be with them. So whether it's a therapist or whether it's somebody who's in ministry or just somebody who's being with somebody else, just healing occurs in this relationship that just happens without strings.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you were saying, Jonathan, too, is, and this wasn't planned, like he's just saying stuff that's actually in the research, right? So one of the things is, and I think it's why a lot of people come to therapists instead of pastoral counselors or whatever, because that companion who comes alongside in those spiritual struggles has to be unbiased, has to be not trying to steer in a certain direction. I get that one of the goals and aims of a church or a religious institution is to form disciples according to a certain framework. I mean, it's just part of the mission in some ways, right? But the, one of the most healing things that I think therapy can offer, but I also think friendships can offer and safe spaces can offer, is you get to wrestle with this any way you want to. I'm not trying to steer you in any direction. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. And it finally gives, again, heals some of that power imbalance. I'm not trying to make you do something. And it gives you an actual safe space to really wrestle with stuff. Yeah.
You talked earlier just about the importance of someone being a witness to struggles. And I think that in some ways, that's so much of what we try to do with ministry is just to say, I see you, you know, maybe you feel like no one else sees you, but I see you. And I affirm that what happened to you is real, that it really exists. And I'm here with you, you know, without judgment, without trying to convert you, but I'm actually here. Yeah. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And when you sent me some of the notes about things we might talk about, I thought it was interesting that you talked about your own story in terms of a parable of two gardens. And I was wondering if you could tell us about this two gardens metaphor, and why it's not just that simple to switch from a conservative fundamentalist church garden to a liberal progressive garden church. Yes. Because, I mean, that was frustrating for me because I was trying to develop this church that was more progressive and open and accepting, and it seemed like the people were leaving the evangelical church and just running right by me, and like, well, why don't you come and try this? I mean, what's wrong with this? So, talk about that.
Okay. So what's interesting is you can be conservative or progressive and be a fundamentalist. If your belief system is so rigid, whether it's conservative or progressive, it's still rigid. They're still not, it's still, okay, yeah, this is, to go to the progressive camp would have just been, or garden would have just been, well, now these are the right things to believe. And I think one of the best things I ever did, and let me just tell you, I recommend it to anybody, is after I fell to the bottom of that pond, I came back and I got a spiritual director. And it was probably one of the best decisions I ever made. And she really walked me through some of that. And I think that's the reason why that metaphor of two gardens came up, because my very first spiritual direction session, I was kind of telling her, I mean, I'm bawling and I'm just telling her all the things. I don't even know if I believe in God anymore. What if I do? And what if I never go back to God? And I'm just almost sobbing. And she just said to me, she goes, Tana, you don't sound like somebody who wants to be disconnected from God. And she was right, you know, just observing that. But I just told her, I gave up. I told God I quit. And she goes, rest is holy. You know, and she kind of used that passage from Leviticus. And she was talking about how every Sabbath year, you just let the ground lie, you know, prune it. Now, she told an achiever not to prune or plow. Or I'm like, whoa, right? And I did. I stopped everything. COVID gave me a great excuse not to go back to church. I didn't. Those quiet times, nope. I didn't even want to open the Bible, honestly, at that point in my life. I just let the ground lie. And what began to happen through that was, you know, I realized that I'd been given all these belief systems in my evangelical garden, if you will. And I really resisted just reading more stuff from a progressive lens and moving into that other garden. And I didn't realize I was tending my own garden, I guess, if we could continue with a metaphor. Like, learning to listen to myself what? Wait a minute. I'm a woman in a Southern Baptist convention. I mean, we don't listen to ourselves, especially, right? Can't trust yourself. The heart is deceitful above all else. All those kinds of things, right? So this idea that I could listen to my soul, and that's what my spiritual director asked me at the beginning of every session. How's your soul? When she first asked me that question, I'm like, I don't even know what that means. How is my soul? Well, learning that my soul is this place where I'm at home with God, that I'm my most authentic self in God's presence, who God made me to be, and I can listen to that part of me. And so I was kind of cultivating my own garden. And it does have some elements of both gardens. I still kind of like the Bible. I don't see it the same. I don't interpret the same. I still think God had a point in giving it to us. But now I'm kind of in the progressive garden in some ways, like gender issues, LGBTQ issues, you know, things like that. So, mm-hmm. But it's my garden, you know, and the walls came down and a lot of things I didn't know the walls were going to come down on, but my garden's going pretty well. So,
well, we talked about how, like, the idea of grace saving all or universal salvation. You said that it's just really helpful that people have some options. And you said there's even some research that shows that. And so I know that the point of Open Table Faith is to help people to have options. So to expose them to, like, maybe Christian Universalism as a possible way to think about their Christian faith, whether it ultimately works for them or not. So talk a little bit about having different options, feeling free to sort of have your own agency to determine what option kind of seems most helpful to you, or just the freedom to even investigate different options, about just feeling that free to do that and not like you're doing anything wrong in doing that. Talk about that. So,
yeah. So one of the things we know from the spiritual struggles literature and research is that one of the things that send people into a time of spiritual struggle is a limited and narrow belief system. And it's typically binary, or it's typically like this or this, black or white. There's a real big emphasis, I think we all know, kind of within in evangelicalism, of certainty. So faith is not really about trust, or it's about being certain of doctrines. The Bible clearly says all of these things, and things like that. So it's a very strict, restrictive way of looking at things. And just what we know about cognitive flexibility and things like that within the literature is, like, people do better when they have the ability to see different perspectives. And so that's why I kind of made the joke about, well, I don't think it's a joke, about you can be a progressive fundamentalist, because if that's your only lens, it's still not cognitive flexibility. You're just a progressive who's strict and black and white thinking, right? So what we want to do is we want to open that up and we want to expand it. We've got to give people permission to kind of think about things in that way. I think for me personally, the biggest switch for me came just being at TCU and getting my doctorate there. They specialize in solution-focused brief therapy, which is a postmodern therapy. So we got a real heavy dose of postmodern therapies. Well, you've got to kind of understand what postmodernism is and the critiques of modernism and all those kinds of things. And that paradigm shift of kind of moving away from this kind of modernist understanding, there's one capital T true for all people, all times, kind of thing, to more of a, oh my gosh, you know, faith communities get together and they talk about what they think is true, and that becomes truth. Like, and we see it with, you know, hermeneutics, right? So this is how you interpret the Bible. You want the literal reading? Well, who came up with that? Well, people did. This is how you read the Bible, and this is how you interpret it. And so my whole framework for understanding the Bible shifted mainly philosophically. But once that happens, it's like you can look at the Bible in such a completely different way. And I think that kind of expansiveness is what's really helpful to people.
Well, one of the things if I explain my Christian universalism to somebody and they just automatically agree with every single thing I agree with every single thing you say. I agree with every single thing in your book. I agree with every single way that you put that together. That strikes me as a little bit odd. That's not, you know, really what I'm looking for. But what seems much more healthy is, you know, when somebody says, I think that's interesting what you say, I'm enjoying thinking about it. There were some things that I agreed with. There were some things that, you know, maybe I wouldn't have approached it the same way. And then to have a church in a church community that is able to have those kinds of conversations. That's, I really like the, when we had our theology, pub theology. Yeah, that was in that environment, felt like we were free to all have our own opinions and share it, and that was okay. What the purpose of it was, and now we're all going to agree that this is the exact way that we all have to think about it. So just having that, the openness.
Absolutely. So an author I love, David Dark, has this line. He says, to love a person is to love a process. And so I think making space for the fact that, you know, we want, I know I do, we want to grab for that certainty, whether it's the certainty we had growing up or whether it's, you know, we're changing gardens and we have, you know, grabbing onto that new certainty. But that's important to create space for people who are in process, like we all are, or who are evolving or changing. Like, you don't have to have it all figured out. And it's actually okay that we can have different ideas. We can still be friends. We can still have good discussion. So on that note, I have to mention that, so you appreciated the fact that I didn't agree, David, with everything in your book.
Yeah.
Like, so David, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like you have like the 5 points of your Christian universalism.
Right.
You know,
my picture
kind of
God. Yeah.
Your picture of God. Okay. Kind of riffing on the 5 points of Calvinism. So I once told David jokingly, you know, you've heard of 4-point Calvinists. I said, David, I love your stuff. I consider myself a 4-point Artmanist. And so I'm your favorite 4-point Artmanist.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the thing we had the discussion about is the sovereignty of God, and to how to what extent does God control things or in control of the end of things, and how does all of that work? And so my wife, Amy, teaches Introduction to World Religions at Missouri State. And one of the things that she likes to talk about, talking about Judaism, is that in Judaism, the text is kind of the beginning of the conversation. So for me, my book wasn't the end of the conversation. It was kind of the beginning of the conversation. It's just me putting out the best that I know. And now let's have more interesting conversations about that. And it's certainly okay if people, you know, don't agree with all of it, if it helps. Now, you said that in some of our conversations, Bentana, you said that finding out about that there had been Christians in the early centuries of the church, and that there was a legitimate way to read the Bible towards a conclusion of a universal restoration, that just knowing or discovering that was helpful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Say a little bit about that.
Yeah, maybe save my faith. I think that's exactly what I said to you in the email. I think one of the biggest things I had to deconstruct was I came in through atonement theories. And you may have heard in the introduction, like I have a master's of divinity from Southwestern, and I didn't know there were theories, plural. Like how in the world, right? Like penal substitutionary atonement. That's the good news.
It wasn't a theory. That was Christianity.
That was it. Yeah.
The Bible says it. I believe it. That settles it.
Amen, brother. Amen. Amen. Preach it. So I came in through atonement theories, but the big question in my heart that I could never reconcile, that caused some of that anxious attachment, was, okay, I'm born and I don't have a choice to be born. And I'm born an enemy of God. A child of wrath. I mean, that's what I'm taught, right? And so how can that be true? What if I didn't make the right decision? Or what if I was born in a part of the world that never heard the gospel or something like that? I couldn't wrap my brain around how God, and I like how you said it, kind of the David Bentley Hart argument was, how can a good God know from the beginning that at the end, these children that have been created are going to spend an eternity in hell? Doesn't that mean that's not a good father or a good parent? And being a mom, like everything in me said, if you told me that giving birth to a certain kid was going to mean that they were going to be in torment their entire lives, I would never give birth to a kid.
Or their entire eternity.
Entire eternity,
yeah.
Right? Like, that's not a good mom. Like, and I couldn't do the mental gymnastics. I couldn't gaslight myself anymore. I couldn't call that good. Everything I know that's good and loving is not that, right? And so to me, if I didn't get that solved, if I didn't wrestle with that and come to a different place at least, I didn't know how I could worship that kind of God. The gospel sounded more like a horror story to me than it did anything else. And I did. I grew up in that revivalist Southern Baptist. Every year we're going to have the revivalist come, and he's going to stand up there and preach, "What happens if you die tonight?" And I was that kid out there going, "Okay, God, I praise it." One of the things I found in my journals was a diary. And I'm in the third grade, and there's an entry in there, and it says, "I think God's mad at me. I'm going to rededicate my life tonight." I'm 8. What? What's God mad at an 8-year-old for? What? Like, so for me, I had to do something. But what's also important for me is I didn't want to, again, because I couldn't just go to this garden where, oh, there's no hell. Like, right? And so kind of doing a search initially through the Bible for normal people, kind of sharing somebody.
I just recently interviewed Pete Enns, and he has the same kind of understanding.
You did a wonderful job, by the way, with Pete.
I really love that interview.
Yeah, he's really fun. So it kind of came in through that. But then I just wanted to find a podcast that was kind of exclusively about that question. I found yours, and you handled the kind of using kind of a biblical framework and obviously talking to people who kind of had that as their foundation.
Well, that was one of the things, is that sometimes people will want to say to me, okay, well, if you think everybody ends up in heaven, that means that you don't believe in hell. And I would say, well, I believe in the kind of afterlife judgments that the early church fathers thought about, and that in the coming ages, however long those last, some early church fathers, some fairly prominent ones, thought that God would deal with people however it was necessary to finally restore them and bring them back. And so I still believe sin is every bit as destructive as it ever was, and I don't want anything to do with God's after-death restorative processes. I don't want to have to go through that, but I can trust that whatever needs to finally be taken care of for me or for anybody else, God, as a loving parent, certainly had the ability to make a creation in which he would be able, or God would be able, to do these things. And so I don't like for people to say that I don't believe in hell. I just don't believe in a hell of eternal separation or eternal torment that finally doesn't have a redemptive purpose. And so what that does is it allows people to have a Christian faith that's still pretty recognizable. It just changes that one part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just knowing that it was kind of an orthodox thought and belief for so long. And then when you kind of start reading the Bible differently, kind of maybe this is possible. You start to kind of see it everywhere. Yeah. You're like, oh, this is like every knee shall bow and every tongue confess.
Yeah. Or somebody asked me one time, what's your favorite Bible verse? I said, Lamentations 3, 31 to 33. Well, what's that? Well, it says it says that God does not cast off anyone forever. And they were like, well, that's in the Bible? Yeah. But you're not really, that's not one of the ones that you're taught to memorize, because it doesn't go with, it just doesn't go with the scripture. But once you're allowed, I like to say, once you take you're allowed to put the glasses on, and let me look at some scriptures that might go along with that. I find that people find a lot more than they thought was there. They may not get all the way to the idea that God will reconcile necessarily every single person back. They may have some concerns about free will or some things like that, but they get a much more robust idea that the redemptive plans and purposes of God could be much grander and greater than they were ever allowed to believe. And that right there just helps a lot of people.
Yes.
All right, well, we're kind of coming to the end of our time. So, kind of some final thoughts. Jonathan, do you have anything you want to say just in kind of wrapping up?
I just say, so I know that everyone's journey is different. And I imagine that everybody that comes to see you in therapy or that you talk to has a different set of needs. But just in general, for people who are beginning to ask questions, or for people who have said on their own, I'm done, I quit, and they're looking to you for some kind of a resource to help, what are some things that you would point people toward that are more healthy or holistic spiritual tools or resources that could possibly help them to begin to read, besides the Grace Saves All podcast? Like, that's the top of the list, of course. But besides that, like, is there anything that you consistently say, hey, you might read this or you might listen to this?
Yeah, there's wonderful resources now. That's the thing with this phenomenon of faith deconstruction that's happened recently. So there's lots of podcasts that are kind of geared that way, like Bible for Normal People, Faith for Normal People. The whole Evolving Faith Network, if you're not familiar with that, they have a whole bunch of resources. Sarah Bessie has just published a new book, Survival Notes in the Wilderness or something like that. And the Evolving Faith also has a podcast. Brian McLaren has a great book out, Faith After Doubt. There's some really good resources out there, but I tend to send people, I love that that Bible for Normal People has a Society of Normal People where you can get along, you can have online community, you can access different teaching things, you can talk with other people who are struggling, same with the Evolving Faith Network. So it kind of gets you in community, because a lot of times what's really hard is you're isolated. It's really hard for an evangelical to go, I don't know that I'm what I think about hell anymore, or I might be affirming now, right? You lose friends, like your family gets mad at you. Lots of things can happen. So sometimes those online communities are lifesavers for people if they can't access therapy or find other people that kind of have similar questions, thoughts, wrestlings, and things like that. There's if it's more religious trauma oriented, there's a new book out, Laura Anderson, I believe is her name, Dr. Laura Anderson. She just came out with a book on spiritual trauma. Teresa Pascal, Sacred Wounds, is a wonderful book about spiritual trauma as well. So there's resources out that are coming out all the time that I think are just really wonderful.
Well, what would you like to say kind of in closing from your point of view?
Oh, gosh. I think what I want to do is... I am someone who went through spiritual struggle and stayed connected to God, and I know some people don't. And so I think what I want to say to people who are trying to stay connected to God, like I was, or God's not mad at you if you're wrestling, doubting, struggling, and God may even be glad it's finally happening, because this image you've had of God needs to die. And that's one of the things, like, I found so much room and permission to feel all my feelings, to be mad, to be angry. And I almost kind of felt like God was celebrating it. And so I just want you to know there's room and there's space. You don't have to deny feelings. You don't have to spiritually bypass them. You don't have to restrict yourself in any way. You can lament and scream and shout and not read your Bible or go back to church for a really long time. And some of that's really necessary.
How do people get in touch with your work and find out more about you? I know you tell about your website and your therapy practice.
Yeah, so most of the stuff you can find on my website. One of the great things about having a name like Montana is I'm really easy to find. That's actually a blessing and a curse. Actually, I'm not going to lie. You can Google me. Guess what? Comes up. Me.
Montana. Spell that for everybody.
You know, M-E-N-T-A-N-N-A. So my website is Montana.com. And so you can read more about spiritual struggles. I do some coaching in that for people who are not in the immediate area. Also, you can see kind of about my therapeutic approach. You can read about some of that. I have published some articles, have the book coming out. If you want to access some of those resources, they're all on the website.
All right. Well, Montana Campbell, thank you very much for being on the Grace Saves All podcast. Jonathan Benedetti, thank you for the Open Table Faith and for providing this this scenario where we can record the very first episode of the Grace Saves All live podcast. So let's end with a round of applause. All right.
That was fun. Did y'all have fun?
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.